From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
President Trump was feted in Saudi Arabia and had an awkward reception in Europe. Terrorists hit the UK and Americans kept leaking about the investigation. Trump released a deep-cutting budget and the Congressional Budget Office produced an ugly analysis of the House-passed healthcare bill. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Megan McCardle of Bloomberg View. Welcome, everybody. Donald Trump's first foreign trip is coming to a close, and it looked like it got less fun for him as he made his way from the Mideast to Europe. In Brussels, Trump got a chilly reception from NATO leaders, whom he harangued for not spending as much on defense as they are supposed to, a failure he framed as not paying a debt to the United States. Trump also attacked Germany for what he calls unfair trade practices, threatening to stop Germany from exporting so many cars to the United States. But the biggest rift at the NATO meeting came from Trump's refusal to explicitly endorse Article 5. That's the provision of the NATO treaty that obligates members to defend each other from attack. White House officials had signaled ahead of the speech that Trump would express his support, but he did not do so. Trump's chilly position on mutual defense alarmed some NATO members who are concerned about Russia. European Council President Donald Tusk, who's from Poland, told reporters the U.S. and Europe have, quote, no common position on Russia. Rich, can you explain to me why this isn't making more Republican heads explode? Republicans spent years attacking Barack Obama for failing to show sufficient commitment to our allies. And you know, I realize Trump aligned himself with Saudis and our Gulf Arab allies, but it doesn't feel like he offered that same courtesy to Europe.
Yeah, I would say the speech, you read it line by line, and there's nothing really wrong with it. He mentions Article 5 at the beginning in the course of thanking allies for standing by it after September 11th. And at the end, he says, we'll never forsake our friends. But he doesn't say the magic words of making the absolute commitment himself, which would have been very welcome given all the context. One, just how unhappy Trump seemed to be and how put upon he seemed to be at this meeting, and two, the entire context of what he said over the last year and a half about Russia and about NATO. Now, you know, his advisors and Secretary of State have been clear, we're absolutely committed to NATO, but it would have been nice, yes, for him to put that in black and white himself.
Katrina, what did you make of the speech?
You know, I think just by being there, he's, you know, supporting the NATO role. I hope that Europe, by the way, goes more of its own way. I think there should be more coordination of European-only security. I think what is important to remember is that NATO expansion, a project begun in the early 90s, mid-90s under the Clinton administration, the U.S. mistook membership in and the expansion of a military alliance for a kind of embodiment of liberal ideals. Charles Kupchan, a foreign policy analyst in the New York Times today, I think makes the right point that NATO is getting too big to succeed. I think that there should be a call to end NATO expansion. And I think at that point, you begin to move beyond a military framework and a more inclusive European security architecture, which I think is possible. I think the worst part of this trip, if I could, you kind of elided it, is the Saudi piece. I think the arms sale, which, by the way, there's not much transpartisan activity in our Congress at this moment. You have Justin Amash of the Freedom Caucus and Mark Pocan of the Progressive Caucus, Rand Paul in the Senate, and Chris Murphy are opposing the arms sale. And I think it was a tragic timing alignment that after an election in Iran where you did see reformers win, Donald Trump aligns the United States with corrupt dictatorships and the Saudi corruption project, which has not helped U.S. security in this last period post 9/11, to say the least.
Yeah, Megan, what did you make of that? The president's, you know, fairly warm interaction with the Saudis, also the release of this transcript of this call that the president had back in April with Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines, who's been, you know, overseeing all these extrajudicial killings related to the drug trade, saying that Duterte is doing a great job with fighting drugs in the Philippines. It seems like the president's a lot warmer toward these sort of autocrats than he was to, you know, what are supposed to be our democratic allies in Europe.
I think that that is correct. And I think that there are, you know, Trump is a man of a few simple principles. He wants to win every discussion. And he thinks that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so, you know, liberals really don't like people like Duterte for very good reason. Liberals also really don't like Donald Trump. And, you know, I think that that is some of it, is that a lot of this is just getting cast in, like, whatever Obama didn't do, whatever liberals don't like. I like that.
Could I just say briefly, Obama did, by the way, though Trump is an ultimately transactional president, Obama also held NATO countries to this point about paying 2% of their GDP. I mean, it's not new, idea
Everyone has, like, said, hey, guys, you know, it'd be really nice as if the stuff that you agreed to, you actually then did. That's a longstanding issue with NATO, right? And then all the countries are like, I'm sure that would be nice, but we're not going to. And then that has been the tenor of the discussion broadly for a long time. And, you know, and in some sense, I think that the United States has always had to make a choice of, there is a huge public good to the United States being the world's policeman. I know this is not a fashionable view, particularly among my libertarian friends and co-ideologists. And yet, I think that this is just undeniably the case, is that, you know, there are massive economies of scale in the military. And therefore, having one power who is, for all of my various critiques of our foreign policy, does a lot better with it than any other power you can name, current or past, right? Like, and any other power that had the kind of vastly disproportionate power that the United States has had, has abused it much worse than we have. And Trump is uncomfortable with that. He likes the idea of winning, and so he goes to NATO, and he wants them he wants to get a win out of NATO, because people, especially among the kind of conservatives who vote for him, people think, well, they've been free riding and that's wrong, and, like, punch them into doing something. And I think they are free riding. But I also think that it's better for us that they free ride than that we kind of tell NATO to go take a hike.
What is the cost to the U.S. if we are alienating these leaders in Europe? I mean, you could see the sort of grimacing handshake between Donald Trump and Emmanuel Macron. It's clear that that he is not well liked over there. NATO is a mutual alliance. We talked about how the Europeans helped us out after 9/11. But I guess the question is, what are the tangible consequences, if any, to the United States if Europeans become less eager to cooperate with us?
Well, I think disliking him is not a problem. The problem is if they lose faith in U.S. credibility and reliability, and in which case you would ultimately, and this would play out over a long time, so I don't think Donald Trump really can do it on his own unless it gets much, much worse, but you'd see every country scattering in their own directions, and the weaker countries bandwagoning, with the most aggressive country on the continent would be Russia. And you'd see the same thing in Asia. You'd see more bandwagoning with China. And I think in theory, you would just want Germany to rearm in a major way. In Asia, the same thing with Japan. But the problem is, everyone has that reaction.
No.
Because of the history, and two, the allies, the surrounding countries, would freak out over it in a way we don't. And this goes to the point Megan was making, when we are the protector. So this is why we created this arrangement in the first place. We right. bombed Germany and Japan into pacifism. They're very attached to that pacifism and to the regime
That's
we
changing.
Created for them. So the only really alternative for stability and order is for us, whether they're paying 2% or not, for us to bear a disproportionate
right,
burden.
Let me step back for a moment. We're in the 21st century. The military still plays a role, but there is a demeaning and a diminution of other forms of power. NATO is a military alliance. It was formed to counter the Soviet Union. Russia is certainly an aggressor in many instances. Partly it is, as Gorbachev used to say, or Reagan, it takes two to tango. There's the U.S. building up presence, Russia reacting, vice versa. But there are regional alliances which are growing, and I think those will play a major role in the 21st century. I also think Donald Trump is about to ravage the United Nations. It is a flawed institution, but there are other ways of countering the great challenges of the 21st century, which are not military ones. Global inequality, pandemics, climate, nuclear. These are issues which demand drawing down, not building up military power. So I think at the end of the day, Donald Trump is, as I said, a transactional president. This foreign trip was played against the backdrop of his America First foreign policy. He made a statement as that he's a realist. So he's playing for the audience back home. But in doing so, by the way, he's dancing around promise that he broke, which, by the way, I thought was a useful promise. The United States should not be the policeman of the world. We should be working with other countries to rebuild a more just and secure world. And policing the world is going to destroy our budgets. It's going to destroy our spirit. And it is very tough to have military misadventure abroad and retain a democracy at home.
I want to turn a little bit and talk about what he said on trade and this, you know, describing the Germans as bad, very bad. And apparently they're saying he just meant that they're very bad on trade, not that they're bad overall. Megan, does the president have a point at all about Germany and trade? I mean, the euro effectively gives Germany a weak currency that does give them a significant advantage of an exporter. Is he right to be complaining about that?
I'm sure, but I actually think, you know, European imports, if you're doing this as an America first, like, what is in our interest? That's all I care about. We don't do foreign adventurism, et cetera. Like, Europe is not our trading partner problem, right? The weak euro, the way that Germany runs these persistent trade surpluses, that's a huge problem for Greece. It's not a huge problem for the United States. And, you know, you sort of wonder, like, why is this the issue that Trump is talking about? On the other hand, like, China, which actually runs huge, right? I mean, China is actually cost a lot of U.S. jobs over the last, like, 10, 20 years. Germany, not so much. And yet, so why is it easier for him to go out and really come out hard against Germany than it is against China? And where I find that interesting.
But so far, every indication is this is just bluster.
Yeah,
he likes saying this. Yeah. He's said it for years. But then when push comes to shove in the actual policy, we've seen no indication that this is where he's going.
True.
Even on China, yeah. You know, for 30 years, he's been banging on China. Wilbur Ross, you know, a week or two waved this Peace in Our Time paper around, you know, that we had the best trade relations ever with China just based on really symbolic concessions.
Has anyone seen that tape, the Oprah tape with Donald that's been floating around the internet? It's
no.
Worth saying. It's like 25, 30 years old. He's stringing words together pretty well. But he goes on about Germany and trade. It's a bee in his bonnet, and people get to him. And you're right, there's bluster. And then I would put it somewhat differently. There's also betrayal of promises. I mean, he doesn't.
But here's the thing,
you know,
it's 30 years ago that was actually more of a credible
more
thing,
serious.
Especially if you're.
Yeah.
Well, but if Germany 30 years ago, you're talking about Volkswagen, you're talking about BMW, you're talking about cars pushing into U.S. markets that had previously basically been owned by the big three. And, you know, this is not, I think, a global economic problem, but certainly for Detroit, it was a problem. Now, I mean, this is really an odd time to be picking on Germany as your major trade problem for the U.S.
Another international matter this week was this terrorist attack in Manchester, England, at an Ariana Grande concert that killed 22 people. One international aspect that has emerged after this attack is that you kept getting these leaks from U.S. officials into the U.S. press about the investigation, including photos of physical evidence from the investigation ending up in the New York Times, greatly angering the United Kingdom, causing the U.K. to stop cooperating with us on intelligence regarding this specific attack. I don't know what to make of this. I don't know what a lot of the leaks that we've seen over the last few months, there's a clear motive, somebody trying to drive the news in a particular direction. It's hard for me to see why American officials entrusted with this UK intelligence would have been leaking it to the press.
Well, the New York Times had a piece about this today that self-serving, but since they published the leak, but it seems right to me. We have a culture of leaking, yeah. And we're used to every single one of these terrorist investigations. We learn stuff really quickly, and we do see pictures really quickly. And so there's a 24-hour suspension of the intelligence cooperation with Britain, and Trump says he's going to track down the leakers. The thing about tracking down the leakers, you can't track down the leakers unless you subpoena the reporters, and then when they refuse to provide their sources, you put them in jail. And then eventually you might get them to break and give you the sources. If you're going to do that, and it's been done, you know, occasionally, the Scooter Libby controversy, it's an enormous undertaking. You know, it will dominate everything. And I can't see this administration really doing it.
I think it's worth stepping back and remembering as we relitigate the matter of leaks. Rich is right. There is a culture media clash between the United States, which has a First Amendment, and Britain, which has an Official
Yes.
Secrecy Act. But I think it's worth remembering that the biggest and most important stories of recent years come because of illegal leaks of classified information. I mean, we wouldn't have learned of CIA secret prisons, of use of torture, of the expansion of America's drone warfare, in Yemen and Pakistan, the widespread surveillance of U.S. citizens by its own government. So I think this is important in a moment where I think you do see the Trump administration and the Brits are trying to gin up an anti-leak, anti-reporter, anti-accountability, anti-transparency because of the tragedy. But I think Rich is right that the Times laid it out pretty well, and we need to remember that history. Trump, of course, has a situational view of leaks. I mean, during the campaign, bring it on. I love WikiLeaks. We all know what he said. But it is the case that in the Comey showdown, a subset of that showdown was revelation that Trump had said he'd like to jail some reporters.
We have to take a break. Let us know what you thought about Trump's first foreign trip on our Facebook page or message us on Twitter. You can also let us know what you'd like to hear us discuss next week. Up ahead, the budget. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Megan McArdle of Bloomberg View is also with us. While Trump was away, his budget director announced his 2018 budget proposal. The budget calls for deep cuts in Medicaid over and above the cuts included in the Republican health care bill. It also cuts food stamps and disability insurance, cuts domestic programs like the National Institutes of Health. One thing the budget proposal does not include is Trump's tax plan. While Trump has said he wants a huge tax cut, one of the largest ever, it's not in this document. Now, I'd note the budget is just a proposal. Several Republican senators have described it as dead on arrival. So, Megan, what do you see as the point of this exercise? Nothing like this budget is going to become law, and it's full of bad math and unpopular ideas, so it's not clear to me how it serves Donald Trump's interests.
Well, I mean, in some sense, there is no point to the exercise of the annual presidential budget except that it is required by law. But, you know, he could basically, like, write down a few bullet points and be like, there's my budget. You know, these things are a little weird because they don't, you know, Congress is what passes the budget. The president doesn't. It's never been entirely clear why this is this giant annual ritual, except that it lays out the kind of priorities of the administration. The problem you run into here is that the administration doesn't exactly have priorities in the normal sense of an administration, right? Donald Trump has a few key signature issues, basically, aside from promising that, you know, healthcare is going to be awesome. He wants to do immigration, he wants to do a big tax cut, and then maybe he wants to do some infrastructure. And that's kind of it. And that's not really enough to do a budget. And I think that you see this in this, which is that—
Well, it's not even in the budget.
Right, no. But I think that what you see is that because Donald Trump does not have a coherent step-by-step plan, which you then kind of try to fit together all into one piece, this is just individuals running wild on what their priorities are and not talking a lot about Donald Trump's priorities because, again, he does not have the experience, the understanding, the knowledge of how Washington works to know that if you want to lay those things out, this is a document where it happens, and you need to be on top of that process and make sure that that document is speaking your language to your people.
Rich, this budget sort of feels like it goes to your point about how there is no Trumpism and the president's populism is basically just rhetoric. We certainly don't see it in this document.
Right. There's no, as Megan was saying, there's no real effort to think through what his priorities are, what his philosophy is, and how it would be reflected in this document. And the point of the document is basically just to have something that you can say is a budget that balances, even if it's based on completely ridiculous assumptions. And there are a number of forms that I think are good. I like the idea of work requirements. Some of the cuts are just trying to get states to take more responsibility for programs that are 90% funded by the federal government for no good reason. But if you leave entitlements off the table, it just means if you want to pretend to get to balance, you have to have highly unrealistic cuts to domestic discretionary spending. And that's what we're looking at here.
Well, I mean, but this budget doesn't leave entitlements off the table. And one interesting conversation people have been having this week is the president promised not to cut Social Security. Now, disability insurance is part of Social Security. When on your paycheck, it says OASDI. That stands for Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance. So, you know, the budget director said, well, when politicians say Social Security, people take that to mean old age benefits. And I think there's actually some truth to that. But still, there are cuts to big entitlement programs proposed in here that do affect a lot of people, including
disability. Absolutely. I mean, the president, this is a president who promised, you know, better health care for Americans. And you're looking at a $1.85 trillion reduction over a decade from Medicaid. You're also looking at something you care about, Josh, fiscal fraud. I mean, this budget has blithe assumptions that we're going to hit 3% annual growth in gross domestic product. That would be nice, but no respectable economist forecaster thinks this is credible. And you have, I think, what both Megan and Rich alluded to. I mean, Martin Wolf of the FT, Financial Times, used a term the other day, plutopopulism. So you got policies for the plutocrats, and you got this populist rhetoric. These, not only the budget, but the healthcare plan expose, I think, the shameless plutocracy and sham populism, and do it on the backs of working people. I was struck when the leader of the Freedom Caucus said this budget went too far because he didn't like the cuts to Meals on Wheels. I mean, you're cutting from the most vulnerable and all of this work requirement, Rich. Sure, but I mean, we've been there, done that. This personal responsibility collides and clashes with lack of jobs or people whose family life is ravaged and can't, you know, there's a safety net, which is a term that conservatives and the right have derided, but there is a purpose to it. And so I would end by saying it's a cruel budget. But I wouldn't be as dismissive, I think Rich was, of what's going to happen with it, because it's not just Trumpian. I mean, you got Republicans in the House who've been there with this stuff before, mimicking some of their cruel reductions and cuts.
The other big budgetary document we got this week was the Congressional Budget Office analysis of the health care bill. Normally, we get these analyses before the bill's passed. The House passed it, and then about 2.5 weeks later, we got the analysis. And it actually doesn't look that different from the last analysis of the last version of the bill in March. 23 million people, they say, would lose health insurance rather than the 24 million under the previous version. What's new this time is the effects on people with pre-existing conditions or otherwise who are perceived by insurers to have high healthcare costs. And the CBO notes that in states that take advantage of the option given to them by Congress to allow insurers to price based on sickness or health, you would see extremely high premiums that would be unaffordable for a substantial number of those people. And I guess the main question I have looking at this is Mitch McConnell came out and said he's not sure the 50 votes are there for a health bill in the Senate. How do we read those tea leaves? Is the Senate going to get something passed, and what's it going to look like?
It's very hard. The CBO score is it's not that meaningful for the Senate process because they are going to substantially rewrite the product out of the House. I think the CBO score is probably too dire on the number of people who would lose insurance. I think the CBO believes too much in the power of the individual mandate. I think it's too optimistic about how many people would gain insurance just if Obamacare were left untouched. But directionally, it's correct. Millions of people will lose health insurance, and that's one of the problems that the Senate should be addressing. And politically and substantively, the CBO is probably a stake through the heart of the MacArthur Amendment that would allow states to waive that pre-existing condition requirement in Obamacare. I thought the Senate was probably going to strip it out anyway, but this would make the chances of that, I think, much more certain.
Megan, what do you? Is there something the Senate could draw up that would look more palatable when it was analyzed?
Well, I mean, they can draw up anything they want, right? Yes, I'm sure that they could. Are they going to? Look, I think that the fact is that Republicans never really wanted to do anything about health care. And, you know, when Trump got elected, much to everyone's surprise, including them, they were completely unprepared for it. And I think that the idea was they actually had a kind of a congressional system that could have just delivered repeal, right? They could have gotten that through Congress. Because that was already basically set up. They'd been working on that under Obama. But when you added replace to it, the entire thing broke down. And that's what we're now looking at, which is that these guys don't have any idea how to replace it, not because there are no Republican ideas for that, but because partly because of the dysfunction in the Congress is that you can no longer do anything without 60 votes. And so now you need to go down to, well, we've got to find a reconciliation, use the budget reconciliation process where I need fewer votes, but then there's a bunch of stuff I can't do. And this weird crippled bills that we're getting are the product of that process. Obama was the last person who basically like passed a big bill, and that was in 2010, where you passed a big bill that didn't have to go through reconciliation. So because of that, you know, they don't really want to touch it. They can't really not. You know, the system is melting down in a bunch of places. It's got to be fixed. And so I think that ultimately they're going to try to punt. And I ultimately don't think that that is going to work.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's your rant?
So we saw in Montana the other day that a good Democrat didn't quite make it. But what I was struck by this past week is a thunderbolt of resistance in New York State. The 9th Assembly District won by Christine Pellegrino, a bold populist who ran an edgy race, kick-ass teacher, union activist, Bernie Sanders delegate, and coming on top of Milwaukee local races, the Philadelphia DA race, Hartford, Connecticut state legislative wins, and Jackson, Mississippi mayoral win. I think we're going to see more state down ballot wins and not these high profile special congressional elections driving the resistance into political, building political power and reconstruction. And that gives me hope this past week.
Rich Lowry.
In that Montana special election that Katrina mentioned, the winner was Republican Greg Gianforte, who body slammed and punched a reporter on the eve of the election when he asked challenging questions, which was appalling enough. But even worse, arguably, has been the justifications for this assault on the right. Now, a lot of us have been arguing in the context of controversies on college campuses that violence is never an appropriate response to unwelcome speech. Apparently, some of our fellow conservatives need to pay more attention.
Megan McArdle.
I'd like to co-sign Rich's point about violence on both sides and not making excuses for it. But I also think there's something to be said about early voting in Montana, which is that this guy body slammed and punched a reporter and then won the election. And because 2/3 of the ballots had already been in, right? And this has been something where on the right, there's been an effort to restrict these ballots. And on the left, it's been, well, you know, now we're cutting off ballot access and so forth. But I think we really need to rethink how far we are stretching out our elections, because we're getting to a point where you have these pieces of information that come out about candidates, and they're not going to have any influence because people have already put their ballots in. And these kind of plans of maybe we could take the ballots back and let people redo them are wildly impractical. So why don't we think about maybe having, I don't know, we could call it Election Day.
For my rant, I suppose I will also talk about Montana. And, you know, people keep talking about Democrats keep getting moral victories and what you need are real victories, not moral victories. But if you look at these three high-profile special elections in Kansas, Georgia, and now Montana, on average, Democrats have outperformed sort of a generic performance based on their 2016 vote count by an average of 9 percentage points. And if that was replicated nationally in 2018, Democrats wouldn't just retake the House. They'd retake it by a wide margin. Now, you will not replicate special elections on general election day. Special elections, by definition, have no incumbent. The intense Democratic energy and fundraising that goes into special elections will be more dispersed when you have an election in every district in the country. But I think, you know, these numbers are in line with where Democrats would need to be if they were going to be on track to take back the House in 2018. So I think, you know, I don't think people should look at these results and get demoralized. There are something like 112 congressional districts that Donald Trump won, but not by as much as he won the state of Montana. Democrats did not need Montana to retake the House, and if they can come this close in Montana, that's a good sign that they can retake the House next year. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Megan McArdle. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.